This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neal Conan is on vacation. Thanks to a recent Supreme Court ruling, as well as certain provisions of the Patriot Act, arguments between civil libertarians and public safety advocates have disturbed the quiet rooms of American libraries. And librarians find themselves in the middle of these arguments about free speech versus public safety. It's their professional mission to give people access to the broadest range of information. But recent developments could compel them to either limit that access or divulge readers' borrowing and browsing habits to law enforcement. It's not the first time librarians have been in this precarious position. In fact, American libraries have long struggled with important but conflicting cultural priorities. Should they provide resources aimed at teaching the best of American values or an open forum for Americans to decide that for themselves? Later in the hour, we'll talk about a new law in Florida that attempts to reduce pharmacy prescription errors by getting doctors to improve their handwriting. And we'll also talk about the selection of Vancouver as the site of the 2010 Winter Olympics. But first, our nation's libraries, their mission, their history, and their future. Join the conversation. How much do you want librarians to monitor what you read? Does the same go for your kids? And when should suspicious reader or browsing habits be brought to the attention of authorities? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. With us now is Matthew Battles. He's the author of Library, An Unquiet History. He's also the coordinating editor of the Harvard Library Bulletin, and he joins us from the Harvard University studio. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Battles.
Oh, thanks for having me on the program.
So why have libraries been unquiet through history?
A good question. Libraries have been unquiet through history because, of course, they've always been beholden to disparate interests. Of course, librarians control the books and readers read them, but they're often purchased by other authorities altogether, perhaps a college or institution or the government or a community of either a town or perhaps a group of people who are interested in getting books and using them together. So there are always competing interests in libraries, cultural and political interests, and they always have to have their say.
Well, traditionally, what has been the role of the public library in American society?
Well, it's changed a great deal as the country has changed, of course. In the early colonial period, there weren't really public libraries as such. There were very few books in North America, although North America was a fairly literate society by European standards. Essentially, people were reading the Bible and then everything else. And libraries began to arise to make everything else accessible to people. In the 18th century, there were, of course, college libraries. Those primarily served as teaching collections for the instruction of students, but they also served professionals and clergy and elites in the communities in which they were located. But those were primarily small and canonical libraries. Everybody who used them more or less knew what was in there, works of classical literature, theology, maybe the latest scientific periodicals from Europe. And people hungered for other kinds of reading, too, and they began to form associations in various communities around, primarily the Northeast. Sort of the stereotype or prototype of this kind of community library was the Library Company of Philadelphia, which Ben Franklin formed in the mid-18th century. He got together with a group of like-minded friends who had actually already had a sort of debating and self-improvement society, and they began to they formed a corporation in order to buy books and use them together, and essentially created a small library. They opened that up to the community, although people couldn't take the books out. It became a kind of quasi-public library, which
people
had
could go
some
there
of the attributes.
And people could go there and read the books. You said they couldn't take
they
them
could.
Out, but they.
Indeed, yeah, and members could take the books out. And this varied from community to community, but they emerged in the 18th century throughout colonial America. Now, later on, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask when sort of the public libraries we've sort of come to know it, like what was the first model for that, I guess?
Sure. Well, in the 19th century, things begin to change in terms of reading material. Both the quantity and the diversity of reading material change dramatically because of the introduction of mechanical presses. Suddenly, reading material became a kind of commodity. It became a mass-produced product for the first time, really. And libraries began to develop to reflect that fact. Also at the same time, American society was becoming wealthier and more stratified, and people in communities around the country began to, elites began to see the endowment of libraries as a way of expressing their paternity in the community. And so you begin to see public libraries emerge in the early and mid-19th century in America that look much like libraries that we have today. Although they tended to be sort of grandiose in terms of architecture, and they were often Romanesque or Gothic in style, and were seen as a centerpiece of the kind of the vision the community had of itself. Later on in the 19th century, of course, this kind of is all overturned by Andrew Carnegie, who makes enormous amounts of money available for the endowment of public libraries in major cities, branch libraries, and of course most famously in small towns across the country.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say his motives were rather different because he was interested in individuals using libraries. He actually had his name on less than a quarter of the libraries he endowed, and communities really took ownership of these libraries, which were simple architecturally and which they filled with books as they saw fit. And he was very interested in what use people made of libraries, individual people, rather than a community as a whole. And that sort of sets the stage, I think, for our consciousness of what a public library is and what it means to a community today.
Yeah. Well, you've described Americans' feeling about libraries as almost religious, which I think is so interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's really been an aspect of the history of libraries going back to antiquity. The libraries at Alexandria in Egypt were in the temple precincts, and throughout the classical period, you would find libraries attached to temples. I think there's something about the printed word, or before that, the manuscript, that is a sort of aspect of divinity. I mean, there are theological underpinnings for this, and you know, the accumulation of so much printed material in one place, particularly as libraries begin to get large in the 19th century, seems to intimate the divine or the sort of totality of the universe in a way that I think was intended to inspire a kind of awe among readers or would-be readers in libraries.
Divine though they may be, they have not been devoid of politics. what about the politics of the library? I mean, this show is going to be focusing on a couple of very current issues, which are getting librarians to be politically active. Have they always been politically active? Has politics always been part of the librarian's job?
Yeah, you know, I think that I would say that the politics of the time have always been reflected in libraries. The issues change as the issues change for society as a whole. You know, in the early 19th century, as the concept of race in its particular kind of American flavor coalesced, black Americans, free black Americans, were increasingly shut out of these kinds of subscription libraries and early public libraries, a trend that, of course, continued through the 19th century, through the Reconstruction period, and was quite strong in the Jim Crow South, in which libraries for blacks and whites were completely separate, and it was very difficult for African Americans to get access to library facilities in the 19th century, particularly before the Civil War. Groups of blacks in major cities would band together and form their own subscription libraries, their own lending libraries, in order to create a space in which they could not only participate in what they saw as the beneficial aspects of libraries in wider society, but also create a kind of dissident space where they could exchange information, where they could discuss the cause of freedom, and it became a political organ as well as a social organ.
Many librarians today are concerned about the Patriot Act and its effect on intellectual freedom. Are there historical parallels for that kind of political struggle in libraries?
There are. I think the most recent and sort of shockingly similar precedent for this occurred in the 1970s. The FBI began a program in the early 70s called the Library Awareness Program, in which they actually visited libraries and tried to keep tabs on readers, particularly readers who they thought might have come from Soviet countries, people with foreign-sounding names or foreign accents. And they pressured librarians at major university libraries, such as the University of Maryland, Columbia, NYU, and also the New York Public Library, to provide them information about the reading habits, the circulation patterns of people who fit this ethnic profile of a Soviet. They were afraid that the Soviets might be accessing our scientific information by going through journals and public popular science periodicals and that sort of thing. And librarians who resisted this were actually investigated covertly by the FBI. And in the 80s, this was exposed. There was a New York Times article, I think 1987, that exposed this. And as a result of that, there were a lot of statutes put on the books, both in municipalities and at the state level, that underscored the importance of the privacy of the library patron, which has been an aspect of the sort of professional code of ethics among librarians, really, insofar as I know, since the 30s, another time of political discord in the states, when the American Library Association began to try to pull together a code of ethics to determine how librarians should respond to certain political situations. And in those early codes of ethics in the 30s, there was language about the privacy of the individual patron.
And the other issue, the question of pornography available on the internet, there must be some precedent there too in past disputes over obscene literature in libraries. I mean, is
Absolutely.
There any echoes there?
Absolutely. It's been an issue in the library, and particularly in American libraries, because the scandalous and the obscene have been, I think, enduring themes in kind of reflexive cultural criticism in America. In the 19th century, the Boston Athenaeum, a private library that was one of these subscription libraries that was open to the public, but was used mostly by its members, was a very richly endowed library. And, of course, Boston had very strong censorship laws. The Boston Athenaeum dealt with this by creating what they called a scruple room, which was a place where they kept all the banned books, and members only could go in there and, in the language of the time, use the books as they saw fit. And that was a way of kind of controlling these energies and yet making access possible. So, the concern over obscene literature and access to it has taken a similar shape throughout the history of the library. And, of course, the issues have been similar throughout time as well. I know in the Harvard College Library, there was a case called the Dante case, which is where they put books that had sort of Renaissance pornography in them, and also the works of modern psychoanalysts, which discuss sex as well, and students needed to get a librarian to unlock that for them. There was a wonderful letter that a student wrote after leaving the college anonymously, because he'd absconded with a number of these books by Freud and Krafft-Ebing and others, and they'd been missing for a long time, and he returned them to the library with a wonderful letter saying, "It's ridiculous that I have to go through this ignominy of being escorted to this case and having it unlocked and this kind of ritual performed around perfectly legitimate reading pursuit."
Matthew Battles is the author of Library and Unquiet History. We are talking about American libraries today. How do they balance intellectual freedom and homeland security? We'll be taking your calls at 800-989-TALK, and you can send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about America's libraries and their evolving role in our society. We've been speaking with Matthew Battle, author of Library and Unquiet History. Joining us now is Judith Krug, director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association. She joins us by phone from her office in Chicago to talk about the Supreme Court's latest ruling on internet access and public libraries. Thanks for joining us, Judith.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And again, our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Judith, perhaps you could begin by just reminding our listeners of what exactly the court decided regarding the Children Internet Protection Act.
Correct. The court on Monday, the 23rd of June, handed down a decision which basically indicated in a plurality decision there was not a majority who joined the reasoning of the four justices headed by Rehnquist. But in the majority opinion, they upheld the constitutionality of the Children's Internet Protection Act because, according to the Solicitor General, any adult could request any librarian to turn off a filter and the filter would be turned off. On the basis of that reasoning, six justices agreed that for children, this law should be upheld, and of course, the filter could be disabled for any adult who so requested.
You sound a little bit skeptical about the fact that the filter can be disabled.
Oh, that's coming through. Yes, I am somewhat skeptical, and it really depends on the filter that has been used in the individual library and where it is placed in the system. In other words, if the filter is placed at a system level, it is close to impossible, according to my colleagues, to turn off the filter on individual machines. That in order to disable a filter on an individual machine, you have to basically disable the filter for the entire system. In his concurring opinion, Justice Kennedy indicated that given the fact that librarians were now faced with the necessity of turning off the filter for any adult who so requests, that it was incumbent on the filtering companies to develop a disabling mechanism that was both quickly and easily used. So we are waiting to see what the filtering companies might come up with.
Now, here's a case which we've just been talking about, the fact that over the years libraries have frequently had to balance or had to weigh two different issues, two different goods, I guess you could say, one against the other, regarding the public. And in this case, you've got a law in place that's meant to protect children from pornography, and that's what's been upheld. And yet the conflicting value is freedom of speech or access to all information that's available at all libraries. I mean,
exactly.
How do you weigh those two things?
Well, the truth is, Lynn, that librarians were not sitting around waiting for either Congress or the United States Supreme Court to tell us that we had to protect children from information and ideas that they were not ready for and that might possibly be harmful. And so we had instituted mechanisms, activities, programs way before the court came down with its decision in order to assist young people not only to help them stay away from information and ideas that was not meant for them, but also to help them develop what we in the profession call digital literacy, so that they knew how to deal with the internet, how to use the information, and yes, how to protect themselves from accessing that which would have been detrimental. So we were not sitting around waiting, and now, of course, the issue has been taken out of our hands, and we have been directed to apply filters, which are mechanical devices that neither think nor are capable of making judgments, but they are going to put these devices on computers and are going to blithely walk away believing that children are protected.
Now, one other aspect of this is that this only applies to libraries that are accepting federal money, correct?
I mean, accepting certain kinds of federal money.
And some libraries are already existing or going on without using federal funds.
Well, once we filed suit, which was 2 years ago, then the issue was in abeyance until the litigation was completed. And indeed, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals said that the law was unconstitutional, and therefore we were to pay no attention to any guidelines that had been issued before that time. But now libraries are having to decide whether they do want the E-rate funding or whether they want LSTA funds, Library Services and Technology Act funds, both of which are specifically set up to allow libraries to connect their computers with the Internet. So libraries have to decide if they are going to take this money for that specific purpose or if they are going to be able to juggle their budgets, in effect, in order to hook up their computers and pull the money from other areas where there still might be funding available from various sources. You know, the problem, of course, is that millions, and we're talking 14 million people, only have access to the Internet through their local public libraries. They do not have that access through home, work, or school, so that they are dependent on their local public libraries in an age which is rapidly becoming a computer/internet era. So much information is accessed over the Internet that it's almost impossible to live in the world today without having means to have that information available.
Judith, while you're still with us, I'd like to take a call. Sharon in La Mesa, California. Hi, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have several concerns about the library. I was in the library not too long ago, and I noticed, number one, the setup in the library. Our library is all in one large room. The computers are sitting on a table with full viewing access for everyone. When I looked over at the computer, there was what appeared to me to be child pornography on the in-computer. I pointed it out to the librarian. She said that she would have to shut down the entire system because the boxes were all on one server and it would take a little while to do that. So she went ahead and did take care of the problem. However, there were children sitting there using the computers at the same time. My concerns were, number one, the library setups. You know, how do we control this? Number two, I am in favor of freedom of speech, but I was quite concerned over not only child pornography, but also the possibility that this was some sort of criminal activity taking place in the library, whereas with book reviews, I'm sure that type of information would not actually be in the library in a written form.
Judith? I mean, this is the heart of the problem, I think, right there.
She certainly has hit on the heart of the problem. The question is whether the library was filtered or not, because unfortunately, filters are not, they do not take care of the kinds of problems that the caller is calling in across the board. We know that from the trial that filters are notoriously both under-inclusive, in other words, they let through a great deal of information that we would prefer our children not see, but they are also over-inclusive and literally block or filter out vast amounts of information that is legal, useful, and valuable to the user. The problem with what appears to be explicit sexual information may or may not be. It may be health information. It may be information about a variety of topics that on first glance may appear to be something that it is not. We've had examples of young people, for instance, I remember one example that came across my desk of a young woman who was looking at a site that dealt with breast cancer, but the only thing that was coming up on the screen were pictures of breasts. And someone complained, and the young woman literally broke down and left the library and did not return. But here was a young woman who needed this information, and to somebody passing by, it appeared that she was looking at information that she should not have been accessing in the library.
Yes.
So there are many problems, and we're hoping that we are going to be able to limit the kinds of material that does come in, but some is going to slip by,
right,
whether there's a filter there or not.
Thanks so much for your call, Sharon. Let's move on to another call from Rob, and he is in Oakland, California. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I've never quite understood what's so difficult. I understand in some libraries they might not have the room for this, but what's so difficult about having a bank of computers that children can use and a bank of computers that adults can use? Filter the children's computers. I don't understand what's so hard about that.
I think that most libraries have just that, particularly in libraries that have children's rooms, and even in those libraries that have sections, even if it is a one-room library, there are sections specifically set aside for children. Not only do most libraries have separate computers for young people, but they also, rather than using filters, would bring in materials on a white list or a green list, depending on
on the
language used, so that the children are accessing information that is appropriate for them and for their age. The real problem, in my opinion, is not the children per se, the young kids, but more the teenagers and who have a need for certain kinds of information that might appear to someone outside their family or their direct circle of family, friends, clergy, etc.,
who know what
to be inappropriate.
To. Yeah.
And yet, you know, teenagers are not only curious, but they have a vast need for information, much of which they don't want to share with their parents because they're either embarrassed or concerned, some of which because it would be dangerous for them to share with their parents. We have example after example of young people who were being abused at home, and the only place they could find the information that they needed was at the library. And now these kids are cut off from that kind of information in many instances.
Okay. Thanks so much for your call, Rob. And Judith Krug, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Judith Krug is the director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association, and she joined us by phone from her office in Chicago. We've also been talking with Matthew Battles. He's the author of Library, An Unquiet History. Matthew, I think what we're hearing here, and I'd just like to hear you talk about this a little bit, is the incredible challenges that libraries are facing with the technological age, in the age of the Internet, and how to deal with that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, when the 20th century began, libraries went through a sort of another change in which the autonomy of the individual, the possibility of the individual was really celebrated in the library, and librarians embraced this vision of the librarian as a sort of information social worker who could put people in touch with information they wanted or needed for either solace or instruction. And now with the Internet, we're sort of reintroduced to the social and political aspects of information, that information has different meanings to different people, and it's become a commodity again, in a sense. In a sense, it's always been that way, but we've allowed a kind of ideal of what a reader's experience of the library should be to obscure that fact for a while, and I think as a result have fallen prey to a certain extent to what is really, in a certain sense, an old, very very difficult discourse in terms of who uses libraries and how they use them.
If you'd like to join our discussion on libraries, the number is 800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now is Ann Turner, Director of Libraries for the Santa Cruz City County Library System. She joins us by phone from her office in Santa Cruz, California. Thanks for being with us, Ann.
You're welcome. Hi.
Now, your library system made waves early this year by posting provisions of the Patriot Act on library walls. What led you to that decision?
Our patrons have been protected by California law in the Constitution to their right to privacy, and the USA Patriot Act subverts that right to privacy. It gives the government the power to find out without showing due cause why they should find out what a particular person is reading, and it also allows the government to go fishing for information. We think maybe there might be a terrorist cell in Santa Cruz, so let's look at the library records and see if people are reading things that might lead us to that. That caused our Library Joint Powers Board to direct me to post warning signs on all our circulation desks, which say that although the Santa Cruz Library makes every effort to protect your privacy, under the federal USA Patriot Act, records of the books and other materials you borrow from this library may be obtained by federal agents. The federal law prohibits library workers from informing you if federal agents have obtained records about you. And if you have questions about the policy, you can direct them to the Attorney General, John Ashcroft.
Now, how did patrons react? I mean, had they known about the Patriot Act and how it affected them, or did they express amazement, surprise when they saw these warnings?
They expressed amazement and surprise and indignation. I think that probably 99% of the comments we've had from patrons have been things like, wait a minute, I am a U.S. citizen and this is not right. I am protected by the Constitution to my right to privacy. That was part of the board's point in directing us to put the warning signs up. They wanted people to understand about the Patriot Act, and they saw it as an education device, and it sure has been that.
Now, I've read that about 5% of librarians who replied to a University of Illinois questionnaire have said that they'd refuse to disclose any information. I think another 16% said they probably would refuse to disclose. I'm wondering what you're telling your librarians to do.
Well, right, the procedures we've always had in place are that any kind of court order we receive, whether it's a federal one under the Patriot Act or a standard one under the California law, is given to me. I take it to the city attorney and ask him to rule on whether it's valid or not, and then I make a decision as to whether I'm going to comply or not. I think that I would not be able to comply morally or politically. I would not be able to comply with a fishing expedition act, a fishing expedition warrant. If it were about a specific user, I would rely on the city attorney's judgment.
Thanks so much. Ann Turner is the Director of Libraries for the Santa Cruz City County Library System. She joined us by phone from her office in Santa Cruz, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Tomorrow, the extended family. The July 4th holiday is the most popular time to gather with our relatives, eat, drink, and share family culture and memories. Does your extended family play an annual or daily role in your life? That's tomorrow at this time. Right now, we're discussing the libraries, and one of our guests today has been Matthew Battles. He's the author of Library and Unquiet History, and we'd like to get a caller on now, Eric, in Michigan. Hi, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think that libraries should monitor what people read, but not to the extent of where they're looking over their shoulder at every moment. But they should report any suspicious activity to the proper authorities.
Why do you feel that?
Well, my old library at my old school would monitor what you read to the point of where if there was death in the book, they would not supply it to you at the library. And that bugged me a lot, so I'd have to go out and buy the books for myself.
So there was censorship in your school library?
Yes, a lot of it.
And you don't want to see that in public libraries?
No, not for books, you know, but for, like, pornography online, I think that's very bad, you know.
And what about security issues, Eric? Are you worried about people using the library in a way that that could be hurtful, that could be used for terrorism, for instance?
I am worried to a certain extent, but I think that people should be allowed to read what they really want to. But if people are researching on bombs at every point that they can possibly get at, I think that would be suspicious activity.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, Eric.
Thank you.
Matthew Battles, I'd love it if you could just help us wrap up this conversation by putting into context really what's going on currently in terms of some of these issues that libraries are confronting with. Put it in context in terms of the whole social history of libraries in this country.
Right. Well, you know, in addition to the erosion of civil liberties, which, of course, is the primary issue, one of the things that disappoints me most about both the CIPA legislation and the Patriot Act is that it's eroding a relationship that librarians have built with patrons really over the last 100 to 150 years. This isn't a relationship that sort of dropped wholly formed from the brow of Zeus. It was historically created over the century that's just passed. And to librarians, that's a very important aspect of their social role, their relationship with patrons as advisors, as confidants, in a sense, that they have a professional relationship with a client, in a sense, and this legislation erodes that. It intrudes once again on this relationship, and now the librarian may be forced into the role of surveillance, of reporting on the activity of readers. Librarians are concerned about compliance in ways they didn't have to be before. These are, again, issues that have waxed and waned through the history of the libraries, but it's disappointing to see it coming back in this form.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Matthew.
Oh, you're welcome.
Matthew Battles is the author of Library: An Unquiet History.